In episode 110 of the GeoTrek podcast, we explore the power of living shorelines and their role in protecting coastal communities. As sea levels rise and storms intensify, traditional hardened shorelines often fall short, while nature-based solutions like living shorelines offer resilience and ecological benefits. Our guest, Ryan Gilbert, a natural resource specialist and a project manager with Headway Environmental, brings deep expertise in coastal environments and will share insights on where these projects work best, the biggest opportunities and challenges in implementing them, and how they are funded. Whether you're a coastal resident, an environmental advocate, or just curious about sustainable solutions, this episode will give you a fresh perspective on how we can work with nature to safeguard our shores. Ryan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have a discussion.
Ryan, so tell us about your background. Like, how did you become so interested in coastal environments and coastal science?
Yeah, so I grew up on the upper Texas Gulf Coast, just across the ferry from Galveston on the Bolivar Peninsula. So from a pretty young age, I was learning about coastal ecology, working on summer projects, building boardwalks through the marshes and things like that. From a pretty young age, I was, interested kind of in the coastal environment. Went on to kind of do an undergraduate degree in marine biology at Texas A&M Galveston. Followed that up by doing a couple of graduate degrees at University of Houston Clear Lake, one in environmental science, one in environmental management. So one a little bit more technically focused, and then the second kind of focused on the regulatory and management side of things. So I've always been super interested, in the coastal environment.
Your studies in environmental management, were they particularly focused on the coast or more broad, or like what did you focus on?
Yeah, they were pretty broad. The program there is really good in that it exposes you to a lot of different things, and that, there's a lot of different sides to environmental issues, whether it be, hazmat or natural resources. There's kind of a few different ways that you can go with it, even, things like pollution control. And so I was exposed to a lot of different areas within kind of the environmental realm, but I've always kind of keyed into that natural resource side. So when I first got into kind of consulting what I do now, I was a little bit of a jack of all trades, working with hazmat stuff, working with natural resource surveys. And I always kind of geared towards natural resources, specifically the coastal environment. Doing things like seagrass surveys or oyster surveys, wetland delineations, kind of particularly within the coastal kind of setting.
When I moved to the upper Texas coast, I was blown away by just how diverse the coastal environment is. You have marine biology, you have oceanography, you have geomorphology, then you have all these things getting into vegetation. And like you mentioned, even hazmat. I mean, it's a really developed area. There's industrial areas. I mean, there's a lot of complexity to it, right?
Yeah, there definitely is. There's a lot going on, particularly with Galveston Bay. I mean, it's kind of a hub for kind of petrochemical, commerce. You have a lot of shipping going on. And then you really have this kind of strong foundation of a natural environment when it comes to, coastal salt marshes, oyster reefs. And then just Texas as a whole kind of differs in that, as you move further south along the coast, you kind of get a different coastal environment that includes things like seagrasses, a little bit more mangroves. There's definitely a lot of variety and kind of diversity, within the Texas coast.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And you see that when you're driving around, you're out in a boat, you're exploring the coast, it really changes from one area to the other. Ryan, one of your passions is living shorelines. Tell us what those are and why are they so important to the environment?
Yeah, so a living shoreline, kind of the simplest definition is that, it's a nature-based alternative to traditional shoreline armoring techniques. So what that means is it incorporates natural components and aims to mimic natural ecosystems rather than, traditional shoreline armoring techniques such as like seawalls, bulkheads. They're really hardened structures that are kind of locked in on the coast. What a living shoreline does is it incorporates those natural elements in a way that, makes the coastline flexible and resilient, and also providing a ton of ecological services that, decades of research has, kind of shown that it's well established that these kind of coastal ecosystems provide, you know, this suite of services to, you know, the more than a third of the world's population that live in coastal areas.
Ryan, when you talk about armoring the coast, are you talking about protecting from coastal flooding? Are you talking about reducing erosion? I mean, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So, you know, the coast is kind of a big area. So, you know, particularly with shoreline armoring, what I mean, shoreline armoring is used in areas where property is threatened by, you know, erosion or storm surge, really anywhere that you might have shoreline retreat, whether it be from like changing sediment dynamics, sea level rise. So anywhere where that property is threatened, you're going to typically have shoreline armoring, and really over the past kind of few hundred years, as kind of coastal developments really amped up, we saw this, ramp up of coastal armoring and kind of shoreline armoring. So, you know, whether it be seawalls, bulkheads, you know, residential properties that are kind of lined, you know, canals with kind of wooden bulkheads. So really anywhere there's coastal development, you kind of see this shoreline armoring happening. In some urban areas, it can get up to where 90% of the shoreline is armored. Really became an extensive practice throughout, you know, coastal areas around the world, it became pretty apparent that there were negative consequences associated with armoring, particularly when it becomes extensive.
So you've mentioned like nature-based solutions as an alternative. I have pictures in my head that may or may not be accurate. I'm picturing maybe like marsh grass, things like that, like where you're actually bringing maybe more vegetation or more wooded areas up to the edge of the water. Is that accurate?
Right. Yeah, it's pretty accurate. So living shorelines, you know, they come in a variety of shapes and sizes. And that's something I might say one or two times throughout this kind of conversation we have. They're so different depending on, you know, the local conditions of that shoreline. So no two living shorelines are going to be the same. But generally, they have two components, two kind of major components, one being a breakwater, which is, you know, a structure that runs kind of parallel to the shoreline, just off the shore in the water. And that can be constructed of, you know, rock, riprap, oyster shells. And so that breakwater functions as kind of the main line of defense to kind of slow wave energy and hold sediment in behind it. But then secondarily, and really where that living component comes in, is, like you said, vegetation planted behind that breakwater. And, you know, usually it's made of, you want to use, you know, native plants. So, you know, in the Galveston area, you know, there's a few Spartina species that we typically use and that are associated with salt marshes. In different regions, so say Florida, they have a lot more mangroves, or even on, you know, the lower Texas Gulf, you see, you know, more use of mangroves. So it's about, you know, establishing that kind of natural vegetative buffer along the shoreline, really in hopes of kind of providing a softer interface rather than that kind of hard concrete, you know, interface between the terrestrial and aquatic environment.
I see what you're saying. So you're kind of considering the local landscape. It sounds like to some degree it's within the context of what would be natural in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, like I said, with you know, let's say Galveston Bay, the upper Texas coast, it's really salt marshes and kind of oyster reefs that form that, you know, natural transition area between the aquatic and terrestrial environment. You know, in other regions, such as, let's say, the West Coast, you still have living shorelines, but they're developed a little bit different in that they focus more on breakwater. There's been some work on kind of kelp forest restoration. So, you know, it's really just about, bolstering the kind of natural shorelines that are in whatever region you're in.
Ryan, so in what settings would we see living shorelines? Like, can this be anywhere in the world, or are there certain things, certain elements or factors we need?
So anywhere that there's coastal developments or, you know, any kind of coastline, you can kind of implement these techniques. Like I said, they come in a lot of shapes and sizes. And kind of what that tells me is that the flexibility of these techniques allow them to be employed in almost any situation. So particularly the coastal space is where a lot of it has been used. That has been used inland as well. But a lot of the focus and research has been coastal areas. And, you know, I want to point out that, living shoreline techniques are used both on. So it can be used to bolster a natural shoreline that hasn't been kind of engineered in any way, but it can also be used to retrofit onto existing bulkheads or kind of armored shorelines.
Interesting. So it really depends. It sounds like you have to have one focus on the environment, but you also need to consider development, what's happened there, what the human footprint looks like as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's part of it is that, you know, the whole reason that living shorelines kind of became a thing is that armoring was becoming so extensive. It's obvious that we need a solution to kind of stabilize shorelines and protect, you know, property and coastal areas. But particularly something that really led to the development of living shoreline techniques is, you know, what we call coastal squeeze. And so that's essentially where, you know, you have shoreline armoring in place. And, you know, the natural ecosystems like, you know, coastal wetlands, they're known for being resilient. But kind of what does that mean? Well, it means that in the face of changing coastal conditions such as sea level rise or sediment dynamics, these ecosystems have the ability to migrate up the coastline so that they can move landward as the water rises. The issue becomes when you put armoring structures in place, it prevents the natural migration of these ecosystems. And so you get this conversion of, you know, coastal wetland habitat into just open water habitat where you lose so many of those ecosystem services that are provided. And so by using living shorelines, you're essentially establishing a buffer zone and kind of a safe haven for this habitat and giving it room to either retreat or even expand outwards rather than putting a hard line, you know, armoring structure on the shoreline that puts that, you know, that's where the shoreline is going to be until it fails. And then it's going to retreat further and further back.
Right. Coastal scientists always talk about how dynamic but adaptable the coastline is. It wants to move around and it sounds like sand as well as some of the vegetation, it wants to migrate and move around. It sounds like you're saying really hard armoring techniques can kind of block and prohibit some of that natural migration.
Yeah, that's correct. And so, you know, you think that when you put these armoring structures in place that, you know, it's going to really hold the line. But ultimately what these armoring structures do is end up reflecting that wave energy. So it gets passed along to an either adjacent or opposing shoreline. It doesn't really stop the wave energy. It just passes it along. Additionally, you have things like scour, where when the wave energy comes in, it gets directed downwards and digs out sediment at the base of the armoring structure, which can then lead to failure of the structure. And it's important to point out that, you know, when these structures, you know, shoreline armoring fails, it ends up causing drastic retreat of the shoreline, much more so than what happened if the armoring structure wasn't there in the first place. And then it offers no kind of, you know, remaining protection after that, once it's kind of been ripped out or failed, and you just have to keep moving the shoreline back. And so where living shorelines come in, you know, they actually can accrete sediment. You know, it's pretty well established that in natural ecosystems and even in restored wetlands that, you know, the vegetation component of these habitats attenuates the wave energy rather than reflects it. So it slows down that wave energy, allows the sediments to settle, and then the root structures of the vegetation can hold the sediment in place and essentially trap that sediment and build the coastline out. So that's kind of one of the main benefits of living shorelines.
So where living shorelines are working, in some cases you'll get more deposition of sediment or just really trapping it and keeping it in the system, right?
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, important when we think about, you know, particularly kind of the impacts that severe weather or storm surge might have. You know, it's important to realize that, you know, living shoreline is probably still going to get covered by storm surge. But if you can build that coastline out, you know, then you're offering more protection in that sense, you know, rather than just building a wall that might fail from storm surge and then rip out the sediment and cause more retreat of the shoreline.
Ryan, what do you see as the biggest opportunities for creating living shorelines moving forward?
Yeah, so there's, you know, a ton of opportunity. It's kind of been exploding as a practice, particularly, you know, within Texas. There's been a lot of, you know, it's kind of funny to say in this kind of climate, but there's been a lot of bipartisan support for these type of solutions, which is a really good thing to see. And I think it's because they work. So I think, you know, the most recent round of kind of NOAA funding, which is just one agency, had about $100 million of funding for these types of projects, you know, over the next few years. There's additional funding kind of from state agencies. So there's a lot of money that's being invested in these kind of techniques that build a resilient coastline. And so, you know, particularly within Texas, we have over 3,000 miles of shoreline. So that's a lot of shoreline that can be developed, you know, into a living shoreline rather than an armoring structure. So I think there's a ton of potential for it, you know, and even other factors within the Texas environment, such as kind of our natural oyster population, you know, they actually produce a lot more what's called spat, which is what kind of you know, makes the oyster and then it attaches to something. Our oysters here produce a ton of spat. So you can essentially put rock out in the water and it's going to start growing oysters on it. So there's, I think, huge potential for these techniques to kind of be employed within, you know, the Texas coastal space.
Oh, that's huge. And Ryan, you brought up that really in general, you're seeing a lot of bipartisan support of living shorelines. Huge in the news right now is the funding of NOAA and coastal programs and coastal management. Right. In general, how do the costs of living shorelines compare to armored shorelines? Is there a ratio? Has anyone looked into that?
Yeah, there's been quite a few studies. Even NOAA has put out some documents, you know, kind of implementation manuals about living shorelines that, you know, I would, you know, refer anyone to go to them, where they did some cost estimates. And, you know, what we find is that, you know, they are comparable, if not cheaper in the long run when it comes to shoreline armoring. I will caveat that by saying, you know, in areas like the Chesapeake Bay region, where a lot of this work on living shorelines started, they have state legislation that requires living shorelines to be the first option. And kind of as a result of that, the cost of developing these projects has gone down because there's such a so frequently used as opposed to shoreline armoring. Here in Texas, you know, shoreline armoring and bulkheading is kind of the primary way. That's the bread and butter for companies that do kind of this shoreline protection. So at this time, the cost, you know, is probably a little bit cheaper to do that just because living shorelines aren't as popular of an option. But we expect as they become more popular and more used that contractors get more familiar with these techniques and the price will drop down. And then it's important to note that you're building a system. You know, living shorelines are kind of a growing system and they develop over years as opposed to hardened systems. They're either going to break and fail, you know, and you have to replace them then. So kind of living shorelines are a little bit more sustainable from a cost perspective. When we think of decades down the road, it's going to be a self-sustaining systems in terms of, you know, whether it's oysters rebuilding the reef or plants, you know, regrowing year to year, it's kind of self-sustaining that investment, you know?
It sounds like in the long term that, you know, it sounds like when you're discerning living shorelines, you need to think long term to maybe maximize those benefits, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, another important thing to point out is that, you know, we have decades of research on kind of how natural coastal systems and both restored wetlands behave. And so we know that, you know, the benefits that you get from living shorelines, you know, they're going to occur on a timetable. So, you know, in terms of the vegetation component, you know, you might start getting those services and benefits within a few growing seasons. When it comes to in terms of habitat usage and how frequently it's used, those types of ecological functions might take decades in order to reach parity with the natural environment. So it's definitely important to realize that it happens on kind of, you know, a longer time scale than, you know, you would think.
Ryan, how does a dialogue shift if we're talking about living shorelines to protect residential areas compared to maybe commercial or industrial?
Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the areas, particularly within Texas, that, you know, there's a lot of potential for living shorelines to be developed. Texas has quite a bit of privately owned shoreline, whether it be residential, you know, or industrial facilities. So there's a lot of, you know, potential for residential areas to be protected by living shorelines. And you see a lot of things recently, you know, the Galveston Bay Foundation promotes these kind of oyster gardens where, you know, on residential properties, people are, you know, bagging oyster shells and building their own little oyster reefs off of their residential property. So I think, you know, it has, you know, enormous applicability to kind of small scale, you know, function in terms of the living shoreline. But really what I see, you know, there's also huge potential for the industrial sites, right? Sites that, you know, one of the main things about living shorelines is that, you know, by providing that natural buffer zone, you're kind of slowing the release of stormwater. And so, you know, in these industrial areas where stormwater might contain pollutants or, you know, have a ton of nutrients, things like that, you know, there's a lot of applicability in slowing down the dispersal of kind of those nutrients and pollutants. So if we can get, you know, industrial facilities to install vegetative buffers along, you know, their shorelines, it can help, you know, in the instance of, you know, preventing spills or things like that. It can kind of serve as a buffer to prevent it from getting to the aquatic environment.
Ryan, this what I love about living shorelines, it seems it's so applied, it's so applicable to all these coastal management programs. We're going to continue asking you some more insights on this. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this episode, but we're going to take a short break for one of our favorite segments of the program called Weathered Wisdom, where we ask each guest to share about a weather event that shaped or influenced them either personally or professionally. So for a lot of times, this could be a severe weather outbreak or hurricane. For a lot of our guests, it's something major. But for others, it's just something maybe more memorable that happened when they're a child. So Ryan, for you, when you think back about a big weather event that maybe influenced you in your life, what's your weathered wisdom?
Yeah, this one's easy for me. So growing up in Bolivar, you know, you're right on the front line when it comes to hurricanes. So in 2008, I was a sophomore in high school at that time, and we had Hurricane Ike come through. And the eye passed directly between Bolivar and Galveston, so right there through Bolivar Roads. And Bolivar was on the nasty side of the storm, so to speak, you know, somewhere between like 20 and 30 foot of storm surge. So it essentially, you know, wiped my community out. When we came back, it looked like a bomb had gone off. So, you know, that impacted me pretty heavily. It taught me a lot about kind of how communities can respond when these types of events happen, when you essentially lose everything. And kind of from a personal standpoint, it just, it made me a little bit less kind of materialistic, you know, about the items that you own and whatnot. Like it, you know, it's all just kind of stuff that can be lost at any moment when you kind of face these large scale natural disasters.
For our listeners tuning in, if you're not familiar with the storm surge catastrophe of Hurricane Ike, just do a web search for Bolivar Peninsula Hurricane Ike. You won't believe it. I mean, the entire landscape is just wiped clean, almost like moonscaped. I mean, you can't even see almost every house was gone in some sections from what I understand. Right.
Yeah. And what I'll mention is that week it happened. The week before we had, I think it was either tropical storm or hurricane Category 1 Gustav, and we all evacuated for that, and it ended up missing us, turning at the last minute. And so then we come back the next week and it's, oh, another hurricane coming. So like, I feel like we let our guard down in terms of packing stuff. Like I was like, oh, we're just gonna, it's another 2-day trip and we'll be back, you know, leave some of this stuff, leave some of that, it's not a big deal, just pack the clothes. And then, you know, you come back and you realize kind of the scale of the event that happened, you know?
And Ryan, to clarify, so you lived on Bolivar, right? Because a lot of people go there for weekends or in the summer. You actually live there?
Yeah. I lived in Port Bolivar, which is right across the ferry. You know, luckily my home was still there. It had about 10 feet of water in it. So we had kind of, I guess, you know, things to look through and see what might be salvageable, as opposed to some of my friends that lived like in the Crystal Beach area. There were neighborhoods with 500 homes, and afterwards there's one home left. So, you know, it was a complete kind of wipeout of some areas.
The scale of the catastrophe is just hard to comprehend even to this day. But I think that's really obviously for you that impacted you so much personally. And then it's really interesting because you're working in living shorelines, which protect people from a whole host of problems, including coastal flooding. So here you are working professionally in something that can really help communities survive something that impacted you so personally.
Yeah. And that's great. You know, some of the coastal restoration projects that I've worked on, even within the Bolivar area, kind of restoring some large scale marshes using beneficial use material from dredge material and creating acres of marsh like within that area. You know, it kind of meant a lot to me to go back there and kind of contribute back to the community and help build a more resilient coast.
Yeah, Ryan. So in general, my understanding is we're trying to generally build out the coast, right? More vegetation, more sediment, higher dunes. I mean, that's really the challenge for a lot of us on the coast, because the higher the dunes, the more sand, the more vegetation. In general, that's a protection from erosion and coastal flooding for the developed environment, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, a huge reason that kind of living shorelines are getting so much support. You know, like we mentioned earlier, that these things develop on time scales. So it's, you know, it's important that we start kind of adopting these techniques on a systemic basis and a wide scale basis, so that the coastline 10 or 20 years from now is more resilient. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the Ike Dike and building, you know, really kind of hardened structures to protect our coast. And, you know, being a victim of such severe storm surge like Hurricane Ike, like I'm a proponent for the Ike Dike as well. You know, living shorelines aren't a silver bullet in that, you know, they're going to, if we build living shorelines, we're going to stop storm surge everywhere. Like, you still need hardened infrastructure to protect some assets, you know, but if we can incorporate these living shorelines, like I said, in a systemic way, it can really help to kind of bolster the natural environment and also, you know, the developed areas.
Ryan, at a lot of coastal conferences and workshops, I've heard the concept of multiple lines of defense. I mean, do you see shorelines kind of fitting into this bigger picture that they're one of multiple solutions? They have a very important part, but like you said, they're maybe not the silver bullet in all cases.
Right. And that's the way that we move forward as, you know, a coast that's, you know, it's not if a storm comes, it's when, you know, a storm is going to come to the Upper Texas Gulf Coast at one point or another. And we have a lot of stuff to protect. And so it's really about building redundancies, you know, whether that's, you know, through a coastal spine or barrier. But really, from my perspective, it almost has to be with these kind of systemic everyday choices that we make when we're talking about, you know, protecting shorelines. You know, we have to integrate with nature in a way that makes our coastline resilient and not, you know, one structure that's going to fail and we keep retreating backwards. We need something that's flexible and resilient. And I like to think of, you know, living shorelines as like, you know, kind of like brushing your teeth. You know, when you get a toothache, it's too late to brush your teeth, right? Like, these are practices that we need to start implementing now so that when a storm comes, we already have these kind of natural defenses built in, you know?
No, for sure. It sounds like it's almost a way of life and a way of thinking about the coastal environment that you're in tune with it. And like you said, you're thinking about this year in, year out, not just maybe when you had a big storm season or something like that.
Right.
Ryan, I wanted to ask you as well, like, how do you see these projects moving forward? Have you seen communities embrace this, or is it more like from state government or federal government? Like, how do these projects move forward?
Yeah, so there's NOAA has been, you know, one of the biggest federal kind of proponents of these types of nature-based solutions. And obviously, there's a lot going on there. But like I said, it's been kind of bipartisan because these things work so well. Within Texas, we have kind of the Texas General Land Office, which, you know, ultimately owns submerged lands in Texas. So they're kind of the main regulatory authority and kind of really proponent for these types of nature-based solutions. But, you know, on a community scale, you know, I have to give, you know, a real shout out to organizations like the Galveston Bay Foundation. They've been a real driving force in terms of getting these types of techniques adopted. They've, you know, worked with different municipalities, you know, a lot of work with private landowners to kind of get these practices adopted. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, we want it to catch fire and that, you know, one living shoreline will lead to the neighbor doing it and then the next neighbor doing it, because that's ultimately what happened with shoreline armoring. You had this kind of cascading effect of, okay, one person armored their shoreline. Now the neighbor thinks they need to protect their shoreline, so they did a bulkhead as well. If we can kind of mirror that same cascading effect, but with living shorelines, I think it can really kind of take hold and be, you know, the first option of shoreline protection within the region.
Ryan, something that surprised me in this podcast is you've at some points talked about zeroing in on just individual coastal residents who decide what they're going to do at their property level. I expected, you know, this conversation almost completely to be at community level, state level. A few times you've mentioned individuals doing things. You mentioned how they might armor. But I think you mentioned before that you've seen individuals take out bags of oysters at their property level. So sometimes do you actually see individuals say, hey, what my neighbor to the right and left are doing, it, you know, in some ways it affects me, but I'm going to control what I can control, and I'm going to do these steps on my property. It sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah, seen that. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the level of kind of adoption that we need to make kind of systemic changes within the region. You know, I mentioned the Chesapeake Bay region and them having state legislation that requires living shorelines to be the first option. You have to prove that doesn't work before you can do an armoring technique. You know, and that really started at the individual landowner level. You know, of course, there are large expanses of public land where we can protect with living shorelines. But if we can get this adopted on the personal landowner level, I think that's where these kind of small incremental daily changes are going to add up to make the entire coastline of Texas resilient.
So, Ryan, like, do you, Galveston Bay Foundation, sometimes will they have like community workshops where they're trying to educate and tell people, hey, this is what you
should do? Property. Yeah, absolutely. And they've worked with a number of landowners. So for my master's thesis, the focus of it was actually looking at small scale living shoreline. So literally only a few hundred feet, a private landowner, or in one case, it was a small park, but looking at the small scale viability of these living shoreline projects. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, when it comes to the parcels along the Texas shoreline, a lot of it's privately owned. And so because of that, you kind of get these smaller parcels, you know, where these techniques can really be kind of applicable and really digestible kind of at that level, you know?
Well, and you know what I love about this? It sounds like it's a very applied conversation. This isn't just theoretical. It's not just something that has to come out of Washington, D.C. It sounds like these are things that communities or even individuals can embrace and say, hey, I want to apply some of these things moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of one of the biggest obstacles, though. You know, it's an opportunity and an obstacle, you know, from that kind of perspective that, you know, it's getting the word out to individual landowners that this is an option when it comes to protecting your shoreline. You know, if they have erosion happening on their shoreline, you know, they're Googling, the first kind of results they're getting are probably companies that'll come and bulkhead their property in a day or two, you know? And so really, you know, I hope this podcast and, you know, really discussion around living shorelines in general just continues to grow and grow so that, you know, landowners, are aware that this is an option, you know, to protect their shoreline.
Well, Ryan, we appreciate you coming on the podcast. We love applied topics that people say, wait, this is something I can use, or, you know, my son or daughter or nephew can apply right away. So this is going to be good stuff. I think a lot of our listeners may want to reach out to you and, you know, have questions for you or your colleagues. How can people find the work you're doing or just find you online so they could contact you?
Yeah, I would probably recommend LinkedIn as the first option. You know, you can reach out to me on there. You know, I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has related to living shorelines. You know, the company that I work for now, we're a consulting firm, but we kind of specialize in helping clients implement nature-based solutions from a design or permitting perspective. But additionally, I would encourage anyone who has questions about these to reach out to organizations that are in your area, like the Galveston Bay Foundation, or, you know, in the case of Texas, the General Land Office. They can provide a lot of information kind of in a preliminary sense to help you get started and determine whether or not this is, you know, an option worth pursuing for your particular property, which more often than not, it will be.
Well, thanks, Ryan. That's really helpful to help our listeners know what steps they can take to look into this farther on their own. Ryan, as we wrap up this podcast, what is one last take-home message you'd love to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think, you know, for a take-home message, ultimately, you know, it's that shoreline armoring isn't sustainable. You know, as we try to build a resilient coast over the next few decades, you know, by just putting up concrete, we're just going to keep retreating backwards and backwards. And that, you know, to really fight back and build a resilient coast, we're going to have to become one with nature and implement these natural, you know, natural systems that, you know, have existed for thousands, you know, millennium, essentially, you know, and that know how to deal with changing coastal conditions. And as we implement these solutions, you know, there's a ton of benefits that are going to come with it. Reduced, you know, exposure to flood events, you know, increased kind of recreational and commercial fisheries, improved water quality. So, you know, there's so many benefits that can come by adopting this on kind of a wide scale basis.
Brian, thanks so much for sharing those comprehensive perspectives. I think our listeners are really going to want to look into this more. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in person at the Texas Wetlands Conference, April 10th and 11th here in Galveston. It'll be cool to hang out and continue our conversation.
Right. Yeah, I'm excited as well.
Brian, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. And again, I think some of our listeners will be reaching out to you, but really great insights you gave us that are very applied and I think could help a lot of coastlines everywhere. So thanks a lot for coming on the podcast and sharing your insights.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I'm happy to do it.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the GeoTrek podcast and for making us a top podcast on the topic of natural disasters. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.